say, I hope to take the historical perspective and to begin with the colonial period in America and to see how the family structure has changed, if it has, because it's a question, I think we can debate this, to see how the family structure has changed over time, how different is the colonial family from contemporary family. The first point that I'd like to make is that the family in colonial times could be described as a total institution. And by that I mean it was an institution which encompassed within its bounds all the other structures or social institutions that we now have in modern society. The individual's identity was totally bound up with his family. One was not identified apart from one's family. One was known in terms of one's family. The family had the responsibility for the economic provision of its members, for the education of its members, for the social welfare of kin. It had all these responsibilities which are now relegated to institutions such as the educational system, the social security system, the social welfare system, and so on and so on. We're aware of these things existing today. They did not exist in colonial times. Within the family, the father, the equivalent of the pater familias that Professor Hirschfeld spoke about, had total authority within that structure. Not only was he responsible, but he had the authority to control those who were in his care. But the most important function of the family, which it still retains, I think we'll agree on this, was that of the care and upbringing of children. In essence, the socialization of new members into society. Socialization entails teaching new members, teaching children what the norms and values of society are, so that they internalize them, so that they become part of themselves. They don't need to be reminded every day that one ought to do such and such, or one ought not to do such and such. They learn that this is the way an individual who is an American, who lives in an American culture, behaves within certain settings. And this has always been an important function of the family. But to return to the question of education and this function as it was performed by the family, how far did it go? How extensive was it? In those days, in colonial periods, in the time when the Pilgrim Fathers first arrived, and for considerable time after that, the economy of the country was a largely agricultural one. People lived on farms, and they farmed for their living. And this required the use of intensive labor. Every member of the family took part in the economic provision for the household. Essentially, everyone played his part. But the educational function of the father, or the parents, revolved largely around training children in a particular occupation. A father may, for example, be a weaver. He may be weaving cotton or wool, as the case may be. And he would train his children in his own particular trade so that the child would have a craft by which he could earn his living subsequently. Mothers taught daughters similarly the skills of domestic housekeeping. And there were a number of other chores which they had to perform. Women and wives in those days were not, as might be assumed, were not kept in quotes. They weren't kept wives. They did not sit in their homes waiting for their husbands to bring home a paycheck or whatever. Women were very active, and they, in fact, contributed economically to their household. They kept poultry, they were dairy farmers, they spun, they made clothing for their household, They made candles. All these tasks were part of the wives' duties, and they were an enormous contribution to the financial assets of a household. The children, of course, played their part. Not only did women do these chores and perform these activities in order to assist in maintaining the household, but quite often part of their produce would be sold or exchanged for other goods that they needed, so that it was not a merely it was not merely an occasion of some trifling addition to the household, such as keeping a kitchen garden, but it was a very real and substantial contribution to the household. In effect, then, what I'm saying is that both husband and wife shared the economic provider role in colonial times. They both were socializing agents to the extent that both taught their children skills and crafts and the necessary tasks of becoming adults. So that children learned their roles, learned how to become adults within the bosom of the family. There were all these activities occurred within a fairly confined setting because the system was agricultural. The community in which the families lived was a close-knit one, so that members in the community oversaw each other. This meant that the values of the family, the values of society, were constantly being reinforced, both because children were in close contact with their parents for long periods of time, and because the members of the community saw that it was part of their duty to see that young members obeyed the norms and codes of the society. It was very unlikely that violation of norms would pass unnoticed, uncensured in such communities. Social control, then, of individuals in society in those times was very much the responsibility of all the adult members. All the members felt that they had a moral responsibility to other members. Now, some changes occurred in time, and the two most important factors to which most changes attributed are the coming of industrialization and with it urbanization. With those two major changes in the structure of society, that is a major change in the economic structure of the society. It was beginning to change from an agriculturally based society to one that was based on industry. Factories came into existence, so that fathers began to go out to work in factories rather than in their own homes. Working in factories also meant that one had to be closer to the job, so that cities came into existence. And if one lives in an urban area, then, as we do here, one realizes how difficult it is to have even a small kitchen garden. Then farming, agriculture, even on a small scale, is not possible in an urban setting. From this it follows that, for example, mothers and wives were no longer able to make that kind of economic contribution which they used to previously. They couldn't farm, maybe they could continue to spin, but they certainly couldn't produce any poultry. They couldn't keep goats or cows. And so that aspect of the woman's contribution to the household began to fall away. The woman's role began to change. The activity of the man began to move from the household into a place outside the household. What we began to see was a separation of the place of work from the place of residence. And this is typically what we have today. But this began with the introduction of industrialization and the growth of cities. Now, when factories come into existence and when fathers work in factories, it's very unlikely that a father can teach his son a trade as he used to previously. It means also that if the son is to learn a trade, he is unlikely to learn it from his father. It means that the father and son are separated. It means that the father has fewer opportunities to supervise and to control his children than he would have had in the colonial period when life was lived on the farm. So we have here the beginning of a loss of parental control in the family because of the separation of place of work and place of residence. Now, other kinds of changes accompanied these. When industry begins to develop, one needs different kinds of skills. One needs different kinds of training. Children are no longer able to contribute in the same kind of way that they used to previously. That is, they cannot help on the farms because the farms don't exist anymore. So that we have children idle. Now, the society at that time was one that was dominated very strongly by religion. It still is today, but religion was a much more important value in society in those days. And being idle was probably one of the worst sins that it was possible for one to commit. Idleness was not to be permitted. Therefore, children, something had to be done with children. They could not be allowed to remain idle. And this was part of the beginning of the formal educational system. Children were then sent into schools. They weren't the kind of schools that we have today, but they were the rudimentary beginnings of formal education for children. This also ensured, or had the effect, of further separating parents from children and also lessening the influence and authority that parents could exercise over children. There is this split in time and in space between parent and child and his ability to influence his child. I think we all know, even those of us who may not have children ourselves, but at least one would have observed other persons' children. The child who goes to school for the first time and who clings to his mother tearfully, he wants to go home again, he doesn't want to stay in school. And within less than a year, the mother says to him or makes a comment about how he ought to do something, and the response is, "No, Miss So-and-so says that we should do it in such and such a way." Already he has learned that there are other ways of doing things. And in fact, he begins to have other models for behavior. This is an indication of the kind of diminution, if you like, of parental authority when education takes over part of what used to be the parental role. Now, the mechanization of farms, which was part of the industrialization process, also had some effect on what the family structure came to be like. Because it was possible to use fewer hands to do as much work, then labor on farms became capital intensive as opposed to labor intensive. One needed fewer hands because one could use a tractor or some other kind of mechanical tool to perform a task. It meant that sons were not able to find work on their father's farms to the same extent as they might have previously, so that they would then seek occupations elsewhere. Another example of the separation between the parent and the child and the parent's opportunity to supervise and to guide his child. The fact that American society is made up of immigrants constantly arriving, certainly in those times, this was the period when it was happening most rapidly, constantly arriving from different cultures and different societies with different trays meant that, and especially in the cities, meant that society was constantly seething. There was this melange, this boiling going on constantly. And it became somewhat more difficult in an urban setting to retain either specific family cultures or even a community style culture. Now, what other kinds of effects can we see urbanization and industrialization having on the family? I've talked about the changes that have occurred in parental authority, in terms of social control, in education, in preparation for life, and so on. And I mentioned the fact that the growth of cities and the development of factories meant that fathers and sons and daughters eventually went to work in places which were distant from the places in which they had been born, distant from the places where they had their kin, where they had their relations, where they had the only people that they knew intimately. Now, in those days, and we are sorry that the times have changed, one depended to a very large extent on one's kin for all kinds of help. It may be economic, it may be social, but one depended on one's kin. There was no one else to turn to. Movement then from one's community meant an absence of persons to whom one could turn to in times of need. It has resulted in what we now have, the mass society, the urban society, the anonymous society. Movement away from one's kin also meant that one was less subject to supervision. One was less subject to social control by those who knew what the values were that one was supposed to be carrying and observing. In addition to that, movement from a rural area to an urban area often meant a change in style of life. This we are very familiar with these days. We take it as part of the American culture, part of the American way of life. A high degree of geographical mobility, a high degree of social mobility. One may have been born on the farm, and one's father may have been a farmer with a very small piece of land, but one could eventually become the President of the United States. The possibility is there, and we praise these kinds of possibilities. We praise the fact that society permits us to do this kind of thing. But the fact of being socially mobile has its drawbacks as well. It has advantages, some of which I've just mentioned. But when one comes from, for example, a family that is low down in the social scale, let us say lower class or working class, and one works the way up to become a professional or whatever, and one joins, let us say, the upper middle class or even the upper class, if the individual happens to do as well as that, then there tends to be a strain between those who have succeeded and those who have made it and the others who haven't. With the best will in the world, there does tend to be a strain between individuals who are members of a family where this kind of change has occurred. So that social and geographical mobility, while they offer us many advantages, and they are not to be, it's not to be thought that they should not continue to be important features of American life, a price must be paid for enjoying opportunities to be geographically or socially mobile. And those two characteristics are two of the most important features of American society, which have had important effects on the family, some of which I have mentioned. Now, those are some of the major kinds of affects the major kinds of factors that have affected the family as an institution. Other kinds of events, major events, have occurred in society which have influenced what has happened to the family in America. I began by referring to the fact that women and wives used to share the economic provider role in the colonial times. And then there was a period, the beginning of the great swell, the growth of the middle class, when achieving middle class status was contingent on a husband being able to keep his wife at home. In order that a man should enjoy middle class status, that he should enjoy this prestige, he should be able to demonstrate this by not having his wife work. This was important. A man whose wife worked was a man who was unable to keep his family. And no one wanted to be that sort of man. Quite a change from what occurred in the colonial times. But something else came along and other changes have occurred. The effect of two world wars, I think, have had something to do with what has happened to the role of women and wives in American society. The absence of men who went away to fight in the wars meant that there was a vacuum in the labor force. There were places that needed to be filled, there were jobs that were essential and needed to be done, and somebody had to do it. Now remember, all during this time, the value of American society continued to be, and continues to be to a large extent, I think, that the place of the woman is in the home. But they will say there are exceptions. There are exceptions such as when the men go to war to fight for their country, then it is permissible for a woman to go out into the working world. And so she did. Women went out, they worked in the factories during the war, they did the jobs that needed to be done, and then the men came back. But the women did not return to their homes. And this has been the pattern ever since. Now, women have continued to remain at work and as well performing their tasks as child rearers and homemakers, combining these two jobs and doing them pretty efficiently. I think you would all agree. But they have continued to fill the labor market in increasing numbers. The latest figure I saw reported, it's the only piece of statistics I will offer today, and that is, it was reported from Minnesota that a third of the labor force is composed of women. And that's a substantial number of women in the labor force. And I would assume that not all of those women are single women. I would guess that a substantial proportion are married women with children who are working. In fact, the reason that there is so often so much talk about women and women working is the fact that so many of the women who are working are married women who have young children. This is what concerns us. Our concern is that the absence of the woman from the household where they are young children may result in poor child rearing practices and a generation of people who have not imbibed properly the norms and values of American society. So we have here a further change. Women have been contributing to the economic development of the household. They have come back into the household and stayed there for some time, and now they have gone back out into the world and have become once more, and are tending more and more to become so, once more they are demanding, rather, that they share the role of economic provider. They see this not only as useful, because they do this partly because there's a need, but having once been out there, they realize that working in the outside world makes some kind of contribution to their own inner lives. And this they enjoy and tend not to want to give it up. Now, part of the reason that women go out to work has to do with the educational system that I referred to earlier on. The educational system requires that parents send their children to school for a certain number of years at least. The educational system prepares young people for life in the adult world. And it prepares them under a system that is competitive, that is aggressive. It prepares them for occupations and for careers. On the one hand, we have this happening. One value of American society is education. And education is one of the most accepted and popular avenues for social mobility. And so the system prepares young people, male as well as female, for the working world. This is what it does. On the other hand, we have a value that says the most important goal for females is that of becoming wives and mothers. Work in the outside world is not important. Your most important job is that of being a wife and mother and caring for your children and for your husband. Now, there comes a time when there is a clash between those two values. And I think this is what we are observing happening today. More and more women are in fact, taking seriously what they're being taught in school. Instead of simply spending time there, going through the years and thinking, well, I'll get married next year and my husband will take care of the rest, they're taking seriously what they're being taught in school, and then they're deciding to go out to work. They may work for a few years, they may marry, and there are some for whom marriage is important, but it's not the most important goal. They want to marry, but they also want to have a career. And the problem that they're experiencing is, how does one combine those two given our present social structure, those two contradictory aims, those two contradictory goals, which society nonetheless says are appropriate goals for members of American society. So we have this problem which is being faced by young people and by women already in the labor force, some of whom have come to a new view of themselves, partly through the efforts, through the literature, through the media of the women's liberation movement, and through other means. That there is more to life than simply being a mother. Being a mother is important, but working and making an economic contribution can be stimulating, can add something to one's family life, in fact. It does not mean that one has to, it does not mean that one is a poor mother if one also works. It is possible to do both. One might say, if one were a cynic, that perhaps the best thing we could do would be to restrict the education that we give to women. If they weren't educated, then they couldn't hold jobs. But it's quite simple. Then we won't have that problem. But it's very unlikely that women are going to return to the home as full-time homemakers and abandon possibilities of being both homemakers and working persons. Now, another factor that has contributed to making mothers and wives more amenable to the idea of going out to work has been the kinds of changes that technology have made in terms of what happens in homemaking. It's much easier to do a number of tasks in the household than it used to be previously. There are innumerable gadgets and electrical devices that enable a wife to complete her tasks in less than half the time it would have taken her 20 years ago. So that a wife and mother has a great deal more time on her hands, or could do if she did her work efficiently, then she has a great deal of time on her hands to do whatever she wishes to do with it. I am not by any means suggesting that all wives should abandon homemaking if they choose it as a full-time career. Not by any means am I suggesting this. I think that the most important thing is that women should be able to make a choice between the two. They should be able to choose whether they want to be full-time homemakers, housewives, or whether they wish to share their lives with the household and with the outside world. This is the important thing. The question of choice, I think, is essential. Now, the fact that the women work also is made keener by the kinds of demands that society makes on us. We live in a society that's dominated by the idea of consumption. The media, the television, is constantly saying, buy this, buy that, buy more of the other thing. All this requires money. The standard of life is going up in the country. Everyone wants to be as well off as his neighbor. The whole question of status consciousness, of keeping up with the Joneses, is a very real feature of life. In order to do these things, quite often it's important for the wife to go out to work. Quite often one asks the question in a research survey, why does the wife work? And the answer often is, in order to buy this, in order to be able to go away on holiday, and so on and so on, in order to put the children through college, and a whole variety of reasons which have to do with acquiring certain things, either material or otherwise, but things which are considered appropriate by American society. So the stratification system also demands that in cases where a husband's wage is inadequate, that somehow this be supplemented by the wife going out to work. Now, I think the most important change we see occurring now is a change in the value system. I made some reference to this a while ago. Not that marriage is no longer seen as a desirable state, but that it is not felt that it is imperative to sacrifice an occupation for homemaking. Interestingly, one of the anomalies, I think, in the family structure has been, and I think you might observe this, is that the role of the wife has undergone a series of changes, the role of the wife and mother. The role of the husband seems not to have changed very much. His role remains essentially that of economic provider. Traditionally, husbands have not participated in the day-to-day caring and upbringing of children. It has not been seen to be his role. This has been seen to be totally the function of the wife. When the husband has provided economically, he's felt to have done his job. I think one of the changes that we see occurring is that more and more, not only wives, but there's a tone, if you like, in society, which is saying that husbands ought to participate to a greater degree in the socialization of their children. It is not unusual to hear the stories of parents, and particularly fathers, of children who have gone astray one way or another. They've been on drugs, or they've run away. And then the father says, I never got to know him, I never got to know her, because he's been away, he's been busy making money, important, surely, But he's been so busy making money, providing for the family, he has not had the time to get to know his children. Now, I think that with all these sorts of changes occurring in the social structure, changes occurring in the values of society, what we might want to address ourselves to is the question of what do we want the family to do? What do we see as the essential functions of the family? And if we do see certain things as being essentially and uniquely appropriate for a family to perform, then how best can we assist the family to perform these kinds of functions? It's clear that the family is a unit that cannot initiate, at least it seems clear to me, the family is not a unit that initiates change. It tends to respond to changes in other institutions, to other structures, in the economy, in the value system, the stratification system. The family accommodates. It shifts, it moves, it bends. I think the best we can do is to determine how we can help it to accommodate with the least strain to the kinds of changes we see occurring. There's no point in being King Canute. The past will not return. We have to try and make the best of what there is, and at the very least, make some kind of determination as to what kind of future we want to be. The future is what we want it to be. It doesn't occur all on itself. Now, if mothers and wives will work, if their working is important for the economic survival of the family, then it seems to me that perhaps what we could do, I say we as a society, is to try to ensure that those other institutions that most affect the working wife and the working husband are so designed that it makes it possible for husband and wife to work and to care for their families adequately. And I want to make a number of suggestions and to offer to you some examples of the ways in which some other countries, have tried to deal with this kind of question. The kinds of policies that they have set up have not necessarily been designed with the family in mind, but they have that effect, and this is what is important for us. For example, the present system of employment is that everyone goes to work at 8 o'clock or 8:30 in the morning, maybe 9, whatever. But there is a specific time at which everyone arrives at work in a particular office or organization, and everyone goes home at 4 or 5 in the evening. There are any number of situations in which this is not necessary. What has happened in England and in Germany and in Sweden? Some firms in some of these countries have tried some of these sort of techniques I'm going to refer to. Firms will stagger the hours at which employees come to work. It's not important for everyone to be there at 8. Some can come in at 8, some may come in at 9, some may come in at 10. The point is they put in their 8 hours starting from whatever time they arrive. Now, the effect of this would be that if both a husband and a wife worked, for example, then one or the other of them is able to be at home with children, if they are children who are of school age, to see that they are off to school and to do so with a parent's supervision. Now, one parent must sacrifice his working time, if they choose to work, in order to do this. Otherwise, the child is left unsupervised, and this we wouldn't care to have. In Sweden, for example, another technique they use is to have husband and wife sharing a job. And this has the same kind of effect. It means that husband and wife, husband or wife is able to be with the children for considerably more time than would be the case if each had a separate job in a separate institution. Now, we have had shorter and shorter working weeks for quite some time. But the effect of shortening the work week has not been, and the shortening of the work week, I'm speaking of it with reference to husbands, the shortening of the work week has not had the effect, generally, of having fathers spend more time working at being fathers. Fathers have tended to use whatever extra time they have had from a shorter work week for their own personal benefit, either for pursuing their hobbies or whatever they choose to do. Now, a family consists of, if we use a legal definition of a family, of a husband who is father and a mother who is a wife. There are two parents in a family, and if we insist that two parents are essential, as has been done for a long time, then it is important, it is as important for a father to do his fathering as it is for a mother to do her mothering. So that shorter working weeks should have the effect, and fathers should be encouraged, it seems to me, to be fathers and to act out their fathering roles. Another kind of move that one sees occurring, it's a small one, is a trend towards androgyny. And that's the notion that one should try not to emphasize gender traits. This is masculine, that is feminine. This kind of job should only be done by men, and that only by women. This kind of behavior is feminine. That kind of behavior is masculine. What that kind of separation differentiation does, essentially, and it hurts us, is that it leaves us with incomplete people. What we would like to have are whole people. In order to do this, then the de-emphasis on gender traits seems to be an important one. It's as important for a father to be gentle with his daughters as well as his sons, as it is for women to be capable of doing the odd jobs around the house and so on. Some other suggestions I would like to make about ways in which we could help the family given its present tendency. The present tendency being for wives to go out to work. Some of the ways of helping the family, it seems to me, would be the provision of daycare facilities. And I say this, I think, with a difference in terms of how daycare facilities are generally conceived. The kind of suggestions that I would make would be the provision of a facility within a community or within an apartment building so that it becomes comparatively easy for parents to leave their children on the way to work. The provision of a facility within the building, I think, is particularly appealing in that it means that the child remains within a setting, an environment that's familiar. And this makes it so much easier for the child and for the parents. that attributes the more recent problems we've had with young people, the dropout problem, the hippies, the development of communes, the flower children, these have been attributed by some people to the belief in permissive child rearing, which came to be the style of child rearing at one particular phase in our lives. Because we accepted what Benjamin Spock said was right, and that was the way we were going to do it, and this is what we have. At least this is what some people think, at any rate. I suppose what I'm suggesting is that one should not throw out common sense when one starts looking at scientific results. Now, I want to make a few comments on what happens to our aging population, because the family is not simply the parents and the children, because at some stage, parents grow older and children have children, and so we have aging, we have grandparents. The situation we have now in our present time is that there is an increasing aging population, and the base of the population which supports it in terms of social security payments is much smaller. This speaks to the comment that Professor Hirschfeld made about the diminishing birth rate. The size of the family is becoming smaller. The fact that we've had better nutrition, higher standards of living, means that people are growing older, and they're growing older and being fitter at 65 or 70 when they retire. Now, at that age, to retire somebody who is active and alert and to put them into a convalescent home or a home for old people is not really doing them a service. It's not humanitarian. We could make much better use of our old people than we now do. We could, for example, encourage them to remain in their own homes or, at the least, to move into, let us say, apartments designed specifically for them so that it's easy for them to manage. They can retain their own personal things about them so that they continue to feel that they're living in their own homes. It makes for their continuing a vital life, and I think that they can make some contribution to society if they continue to live in this sort of way. The provision of home helps, perhaps, which might assist old people in doing certain kinds of chores, shopping or cleaning, may become difficult for them as they get older. A little assistance in that direction may be all that they need and all that they want, in fact. We have the notion, the value of individualism and privacy, and I think that old people deserve to enjoy these just as much as anyone else. And we can help them to enjoy these things by making some small arrangements, some small concessions to them. We could design houses or housing developments in such a way as to accommodate old people. It is not necessary to separate old people from the younger population. It seems to me that a housing development or an apartment building or whatever, in which, for example, one had, say, the first or the second floor reserved for old people and the rest for individuals of the average age in the population, in which there were old people, middle-aged people, young children, makes for a more complete kind of community than one in which there were absolutely no old people. The mere presence, I think, of old people helps young children assimilate the idea of aging. The idea of aging and death may come, in fact, to be a less fearsome one if one grows up with the notion that people grow from very small babies into old persons who eventually die. And this one has a better chance of observing if one lives in a community where one can observe at first hand and on a daily basis the progression through age that occurs normally. Now, those are some of the suggestions I would make. If we want to see the family continue, if we think that the family is important, because I think it depends on what we think about it. If we think the family is important, if we think the family has some kind of unique contribution to make, if we think that the nuclear structure is the most useful one, we seem to think so, because even if people do not marry legally, they still tend, by and large, to opt for an arrangement of one male and one female in one physical arrangement. If we think all those things are important, then it's up to us to determine how we are going to help the family to perform its functions, given that there are changes occurring all around us in other kinds of structures. Thank you. I'll take any questions that anyone would like to raise on the subject. Yes?
I would like to know why you haven't mentioned anything about the volunteer. The volunteer woman is well educated and has made choices with her family and with her community, has offered something to her community as well as her family, and her husband is completely proud of her offerings. And you haven't mentioned that whole area of women that I've spent 20 years with.
Good question. I think that the work that women do who are in volunteer service is an excellent one, and it's part of the tradition of this country, the notion of voluntary institutions and their development. In fact, many of the what have now become formal institutions and agencies have developed out of voluntary institutions staffed by volunteer workers, mainly women whom you've described, such as yourself. The omission was not intentional. There's simply a limit to how much, I mean, there's a great deal more I could have said about a great many other aspects of family life. The omission was not intentional. But to respond to your question directly, I think they do an excellent job. But I do have one criticism that I would make of volunteer work. And this applies especially now that women are demanding a place in the labor market. It seems to me that the value of work that women do is not counted when it's not paid for. And this is a notion that's other people hold. Certainly John Kenneth Galbraith thinks the same thing of what I've just said. He's made a comment that's quite similar, that what a woman is worth, the value of a woman's work is not counted. The fact that a woman is a housewife is not usually assessed in terms of a monetary value. And the fact that women do volunteer work, that is, they perform certain kinds of services for which there is not a monetary exchange, means that there are some services that are being done, some work that is being done that's not being paid for. It also means, at least it seems to me, that there must be any number of persons who need a job and are unable to do so because many jobs are being done without payment. And those agencies that make use of such services are unlikely to seek to pay for the fulfilling of certain functions when they can, in fact, get the job done for free. I value what volunteer women do, but I'm simply saying that it has that kind of effect on the economy. Yes. Yes.
Didn't the percentage of women in the workforce decrease sometime after the Second World War and then begin increasing again in the 60s?
Yes, that's true. That's true.
I thought that you made the point that once they went to work during the Second World War, that that they were pushed out many times in the factory, replaced by the so-called able-bodied man.
Right, that's...
Along with people that were supposed to have limited abilities, perhaps lower intelligence or something, were given jobs when there was a crisis and had them taken away.
Perfectly true. I mean, what I have done is to... Well, I've made a number of generalizations about the development of the change of women's role. But one of the degree to which women in fact enter the labor force is very largely limited by the number of males who are unemployed. There tends to be a kind of stricture. When there are no men available, then women are accepted into the labor force. When there are more men unemployed, such as when men come back from the war, for example, jobs have to be found for them. Therefore, women tend not to get jobs, not because they don't want them, but because they aren't allowed to take the jobs. The jobs are reserved for men who are seen as the mainstay of a family, and therefore they are supposed to have the first choice. So there has been some rise and fall, but the general trend has been for more and more women to enter the labor force. Yes?
I just would like to comment. I'm a volunteer since I have a little opportunity to work with volunteers, and I visualize a volunteer perhaps using that time in a very creative way to experiment and to personally grow in an opportunity that she couldn't get in a paying job. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a tendency now in volunteering to see it as a stepping stone to other things and not a commitment, a lifelong commitment that sort of puts you in a bind, mm-hmm. but rather as a personal kind of growth experience, helping people along the way and personally changing yourself in a very creative and exploring way,
mm-hmm.
and a real a value to this method.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah, that's a good comment you've made. There's another point that I have had to raise with me in talking about women doing volunteer work, and I really must say that I do not have any personal hard feelings or anything like this about women who do volunteer work. I think that it is it's a virtuous thing. It's a good thing to do if this is what you want to do. But I have had this comment made to me by people who have been in the position of supervising women who do volunteer work. And one of the comments they have made is that it's very difficult to work with women who are volunteers because of the fact that they're not being paid. Because they tend to take the attitude in some cases that, you know, I don't have to come in tomorrow, you know, I don't need this job. As opposed to somebody who is depending on this job for their livelihood. This is just an aside, it's kind of comment I have heard from persons who have worked with volunteer workers. Yes?
Would it be interesting if all the volunteers would quit for a month? I wonder how many women would be hired in their places for real cash.
It would be a very interesting experiment.
There are some side effects of doing things for nothing that are really far-reaching because the material is not the real foundation of the real world. It's a vicious cycle.
Mm-hmm. Right, I agree that the notion of the altruistic ideal of doing something simply for the value of doing it is an important one, certainly. I totally agree with that.
It might have immediate effects of an adverse position, but in the long run,
Yes, good. Thank you.